the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good morning and happy Thursday. Yesterday, we were at the Central Valley Almond Day and got the chance to meet a few of you, as well as Brian and Taylor listened in on some of the seminars regarding irrigation technique, managing weeds, and navel orangeworm. Brian and Taylor will give you guys some updates from the speakers in days to come. In today's news, we will give you a sneak peek of what's to come and talk about how much room for growth there is in the almond industry, which happens to be the second largest export market. And AgNet West's Brian German talks with producers on the benefits of keeping citrus trees shorter, and hear how eggs in a major blockbuster movie have combined forces to promote each other. We will start today's show discussing Trump threatening China with even more tariffs. AgNet West's Taylor Hillman talks how that is affecting people in the ag industry.
China responded to the U.S. enacting tariffs by enacting their own. Now the U.S. is looking to add on to the increase. President Donald Trump announced this week that they would look to add another $200 billion in tariffs to the $50 billion previously threatened. And he added that if China retaliated on those, they would look to add another $200 billion. If that were to happen, the U.S. would be taxing $450 billion of the $505 billion in goods that China sends to the U.S. each year. Former Finance Committee Chair Chuck Grassley shared his concerns this week and says it seems like there's little they can do in this fight.
I'm kind of scared for agriculture. All we can do is continue to let him know how bad that is for agriculture. And then, I guess in turn, you would say that you hope he's got a smart strategy, but right now I can't say that.
Grassley might have taken it a little to the extreme by trying to compare this to something in the past.
You don't necessarily compare the same things that happened in 1930 with what happens now, but if you want to know what happened under Smoot-Hawley, it shut down world trade, brought about the Great Depression, brought about Adolf Hitler, because people in Germany were unemployed, brought Hitler. Then, you know, Hitler started World War II and 60 million people lose their lives.
There's one prime example of USDA research labs adding value to American crops. Bill Ortz is the lead for bioproducts research in his USDA facility in the Bay Area. Ortz said there is a top-notch example that reminds them of why they research different things in their lab.
So one of our enzymologists, one of our scientists, discovered why apples turn brown, and in that discovery figured he could reverse the browning. And it's just adding vitamin C and calcium. So vitamin C and chalk dust combined in the right way, which he patented, prevents an apple from browning for 40 or 50 days in the fridge. And then we patented with a company, and it's been sold to McDonald's, and those are the apple slices you see at McDonald's or Subway or Nature Seal at Safeway.
Ortz said getting to market with a product is their ultimate goal, but it's a goal because it adds value or income to U.S. producers.
We went to market. It's our ultimate goal. We worked with a company. We also enabled the American farmer to sell 65 million pounds of American apples every year with that invention.
So, I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
And now, here's Brian German.
It's National Pollinator Week, which is a time to celebrate pollinators and help spread the word about what can be done to protect them. 11 years ago, the U.S. Senate's unanimous approval and designation of a week in June as National Pollinator Week marked a necessary step toward addressing the serious issue of declining pollinator populations. Pollinator Week has now grown into an international celebration of the valuable ecosystem services provided by bees, birds, butterflies, bats, and beetles. Multiple events have been taking place in honor of Pollinator Week, including the open house hosted by the UC Davis Department of Entomology and Nematology, scheduled to take place on Saturday, June 23rd at the Häagen-Dazs Honeybee Haven on campus. Pollinator health is critically important to food production. An estimated one-third of all foods and beverages are made possible by pollinators, and in the U.S. alone, pollination produces nearly $20 billion worth of products each year. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Mark Dressner of the American Egg Board has some egg-citing news. Dresser explained how a collaboration of eggs and Hollywood led to a cross-promotion of the delicious morning food and a blockbuster movie. Rod Bain has the story.
Mark Dresner thinks it's incredible, too.
The Incredibles 2, if you're looking at the box office figures for the opening weekend, opened at $180 million, which makes it the biggest opening weekend box office in the history of animated films. It is also the eighth biggest opening for films across all genres.
But just as incredible to Dresner of the American Egg Board is its current promotion tied to this blockbuster film. This crossover of The Incredible Egg and The Incredibles 2 includes recipes at the Egg Board website.
We basically extended the How Do You Like Your Eggs brand platform to The Incredibles 2, and now each of them has their own custom recipe.
And television/video ads promoting both the film and the question, How Do You Like Your Eggs?
Egg salad?
Quiche meringue?
Deviled, obviously.
What Dresner points to as the latest example of commodity promotion and research boards crossing over with popular media to get the message out about their products.
Mark Dresner went on to talk more about the promotion. Here's what he had to say.
We have worked very closely with the folks at Disney Pixar, and we have a terrific agency team that is on board with us to create a campaign with a lot of moving parts built around The Incredibles 2 and The Incredible Egg. Disney Pixar actually approached the American Egg Board about a year and a half ago, I believe, with this opportunity. And the reason that they did is The Incredible Egg shares the Incredible moniker with Incredibles, so there's a lot of equity, obviously, to be gained and having that incredible moniker. But the folks at Disney Pixar also felt that the film's messages around family and everyday heroics aligned quite well with The Incredible Egg. And a great deal of our branding, whether it's our nutritional messaging, a lot of the promotional that we work is really designed around family. It's designed around nutritional and growth and health needs. It's designed around convenience, versatility, being able to delight one's family with nutritious, delicious food.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Kenoshita, Tulare County's Ag Commissioner. You're listening to AgNet West Radio.
Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
At the recent spring citrus meeting in Tulare, attendees were presented with information from a UC study about the height of citrus trees and its relation to productivity. Cooperative Extension Citrus and Pistachio Farm Advisor in Kern County, Craig Carlson, noted what tree height appeared to be the most successful.
So if you've got a 20-foot distance between trees, your maximum height should probably be around 16 feet. And I think our study pretty well showed that. So there's no point in having a 20-foot tree if light doesn't reach the bottom of the canopy. You're just moving the entire crop surface, or you're harvesting from up, which leaves you probably 4 or 5 feet at the bottom of the tree with no fruit. You got a tall tree, it's harder to spray to get the spray up there to control insects. You've got a poor person up on a 20-foot ladder, which a lot of them don't even have on their trucks anymore. It's a lot of time taking that sack of oranges, you know, down the tree once you've picked it. There's a lot of efficiency gain by having trees that are shorter. We don't want them so short, though, that it impacts our yield badly, so we got to find that balance.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, during a time when producers are concerned about trade issues, it's nice to know that pork exports to Latin American markets continue to shine. With more on that story, here's U.S. Meat Export Federation's Joe Shealy.
After a record performance in 2017, U.S. pork exports to Central America, South America, and the Dominican Republic have been very strong again this year. At the recent U.S. Meat Export Federation Spring Conference, trade analyst Jessica Spreitzer gave pork producers and exporters an overview of the factors driving this growth. She has more details in this USMEF report.
Colombia, Guatemala, and Honduras have actually had increasing pork production over the last 10 years. Colombia was up 144% in production, but at that same time, their total pork consumption was up 198%. Looking at Guatemala, production was up 7%, but consumption was up 27%. In Honduras, their production was up 27%, but consumption was up 75%. So even though we do have growth in a lot of these markets, in their own production, consumption is growing so much faster that this is giving the opportunity for the U.S. to fill that gap. The DR is a little different. Their production is down. They're rebounding a little bit right now, but they're still down significantly from where they were 10 years ago.
Demographic trends are helping drive pork export growth, but Spreitzer also emphasized the benefits of key free trade agreements.
Pork is an affordable protein that's desirable for the diets in these markets. And looking specifically at Central America, the population has been growing well above the world trend for Guatemala, Honduras, and Panama for the last 10 years. And that's expected to continue to grow over the next 10 years as well. And the U.S. has benefited from preferential duties with its free trade agreements. We have CAFTA DR and then also free trade agreements with Chile, Colombia, Panama, and Peru. These have all been implemented starting in 2004 with Chile. Since that time, we've seen a big gain in market share in a lot of these markets.
For more information, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm Joe Sheely.
Thanks, Joe. And in other news, of course, many eyes are on both the Senate and House this week to see what action may take place concerning the Farm Bill. One of those is National Cattlemen's Beef Association President Kevin Kester.
Farm Bill is getting really close, baby, to something happening positive for agriculture. On the House side, it looks like the Farm Bill today is a Wednesday as we speak. It looks like in the next 24 hours, 36 hours, the House might vote on the floor of the entire Farm Bill, the same version as was voted on and voted down in May. On the Senate side, it'll be on the Senate floor before they go into recess for the 4th of July, probably in the next 10 days. And so if those two things happen, then the Farm Bill will go to the conference. It'll take a few weeks to hammer that out. But if everything goes as expected now, by September 30th, at the expiration of the current Farm Bill, we could have the new one in place.
Again, that's NCBA President and California rancher Kevin Kester. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
What if I told you that America's favorite fruit doesn't grow on a tree? It has to be planted every year. I guess by now you know I'm talking about strawberries. And although it's a crop grown widely in the U.S., you likely know that most of the crop comes from California. One reason is the long and mild winters. You probably don't know that a large volume of strawberries comes to the U.S. imported from Mexico. Well, based on current population, the average person ate 4 pounds of strawberries last year. One other statistic, last year's crop was bigger and better than this year's. And finally, products made from strawberries outsells the fresh variety. I already knew that. Did you? And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Do good things really come in small packages? We shall see. We are here at the Agriculture Department's Farmers Market in Washington in the Veducation tent with our two intrepid Veducators, Hallie Heinzen and Toyana Thompson. Toyana, where did that name come from?
My mom and dad got creative.
Actually, it's a pretty cool name.
I think so.
Yeah, but the name of the food that Toyana and Hallie are attempting to veducate people on today does not have a cool name, in my opinion. Maybe that's why not many people know about this food. Its name, microgreens. Now, what is it, or what are they? Is a microgreen another name for
little baby spinaches and carrots?
No. They're smaller than baby greens.
Ooh, I know. They are really like invisible microscopic foods.
No, they're not that small.
Okay, I got it. Microgreen. A very tiny mini golf putting green, right?
No, it's not.
Then what the heck are they? 2 years ago, we asked people out here that question. Nobody knew. This year, we tried it again. What are microgreens?
I would go with really small greens.
No idea.
Small greens.
Yeah, small green vegetables.
Well, I've never actually seen them before. Today is my first time laying eyes on microgreens.
Don't know. Maybe there's like small lettuce, or maybe it's algae.
Algae, Toyana? Are microgreens algae?
No.
Well, then I'm going nuts here. Nobody knows what microgreens are.
Yeah, that's why we're here today, educating people.
Okay, so please, Hallie, Toyana, educate me, please.
It's really a marketing term used to describe edible greens, which germinate from the seeds of vegetables and herbs, and which are harvested without roots at the seedling stage. So it's very tiny. Even when it's ready to harvest, you're really only cutting about 1.5 to 2 inches from the top of the soil.
You can use any type of plant you want. Anything that has a green top that comes up, you just cut it off real early.
Oh, okay. So some of these that you have here aren't any bigger than a leaf of clover. So, you know, what's the point?
It packs a punch to be so tiny. Oh. A burst of flavor.
It's not just like a garnish to make something look pretty. Like, it has a ton of flavor.
Now, that last voice is Johnny Sparrow, a Washington, D.C. chef. He comes almost every day to a farm to get microgreens for his restaurant. The farm, though, right here in Washington, it's a little room under a bar.
We grow about 30 varieties of microgreens here in this location.
And owner Mary Ackley's doing very well with that, proving microgreens are becoming a little more known and more popular. Toyana says two reasons for that. Of course, the enhanced flavor of microgreens and the many uses of them.
So people put on their salads, on their pizza. You can do burgers, other sandwiches, fish, tacos, or soups. Anything that you just want to add that last bit of flavor to.
And the uses are limited only by your imagination and your culinary courage. And yes, you can find packages of microgreens at most supermarkets and many farmers markets like this one. And Hallie, you promise now, they're not really algae, right?
I hope not.
Yeah, me too. Gary Crawford from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Some homemade organic recipes to use instead of harmful pesticides for your garden. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Ever wonder what farmers did hundreds of years ago to keep critters at bay? We know that the chemicals made today, some of them very harmful to human health, were not available back then. So farmers and households got creative and came up with multiple remedies for removing insects that were annoying not only them in the home, but in their gardens as well. The following are all natural, inexpensive, organic methods for keeping bugs and other critters out of your garden. Consider neem, or salt spray, mineral oil, citrus oil and cayenne pepper mixed together, or soap, citrus oil and water, eucalyptus oil, onion and garlic spray, chrysanthemum flower tea, or tobacco spray. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less from an award-winning chef. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So my recipe today is going to be a butter poached prawn. Now, I've been getting a lot of people asking me about cooking shellfish and how to properly do it in a way where, first of all, with prawns, they're one of the hardest things to cook because a lot of people overcook them. Now, this way of cooking butter poached prawns is very simple, and it's a very delicate touch to the prawn. So if you wanted to do this for some kind of like a crostini or a blini, it's a little bit more fancier than just having a whole bunch of prawns, you know, with butter sauce. But I promise you, the result is unmatched by anything you've ever had. Let's get started. And remember this, if you're interested in hiring me or you have a charity event and you'd like the Untamed Chef to come, www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com, and I respond to all of my emails, and untamedchef777 for my Instagram handle, and I constantly am sharing a lot of knowledge every single day, especially all these recipes on my Instagram page as well. So our recipe is quite simple. What I'm going to be using is a small sauce pot. I'm going to melt down on a very low whisper of a flame 1 pound of butter. And I'm also going to add to that 1 pound of butter, 1 cup of white wine, 1 pound of 1620 prawns. So 1620 is an indication of how many per pound does it equal. So the 16 to 20 prawns equals 1 pound is what we want to be melted down, or we want to be cooked in this melted down butter and white wine. I'm going to add to that 1 whole garlic clove as well. Now, if you like a little bit more garlic, what I highly recommend, do 2 garlic cloves, smash them really good. So that way the natural oils and flavors come right out of that garlic and they infuse into that pot of butter. 2 lemon slices. Now, remember with lemons, they can do a lot of good or they can do a lot of damage. The best way to avoid doing any damage and overcooking is to make sure that when you get your lemon slices, that you remove any seeds from there. That's very, very important because we don't want to be biting in any seeds. You can break your teeth that way. But also, I like to give the lemons a squeeze and then throw the peel inside of the mixture as well, because what that's going to do is infuse that butter. Salt just to taste. With this particular recipe, I don't use any pepper only because it overpowers the prawns.
I like to cook them in that poached butter mixture for approximately 4 minutes on a very low flame. Now, a lot of people think that the prawns are still raw, and that's not true. They're fully cooked, and you can tell the color will completely change, but the texture will remain very, very soft. For this and many more of my Untamed recipes, www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez, and you can call me the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to Agnet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leo. In today's interview segment, Agnet West Taylor Hillman has an interesting story from our friends at the California NRCS. A grower from Northern California was looking for some guidance and soil help and successfully used cover crops to help him with a few issues.
Wendy Crable. I'm the district conservationist for the Colusa Field Office in Colusa County, California.
Wendy, we're talking today about a grower up in your area, Princeton, that contacted you for some help. He's very into the soil and sustainability, and there was a situation you guys helped him with. Talk about that situation a little bit.
Daniel Unruh. He wanted to know what was going on in his soil, and he was in the process. I think he was on his third year of trying a new type of cover crop mix to enhance both soil biology, compaction, and hopefully to combat a phytophthora issue in his orchard. And so he contacted us. He wanted to know, again, you know, what was going on in the soil. So we, Jack Alderson and I, performed on three sites on his orchard. We performed 7 of the 12 soil health tests that you can find online and under NRCS Soil Health. And so we performed both biological, physical, and chemical tests in his orchard. And what we found was actually very low biological activity, which correlates with growing brassicas. What we were doing at that time is just developing a baseline. Okay, this is where we're starting. So that's what that first test was. Again, we found very low biological activity, but that correlates with the with growing brassicas. The idea behind it was he wanted help in finding out what was going on, what he was doing with the soil, seeing if he was on the right track or not.
So he was using a cover crop for a couple of different issues. Did he ever see an improvement?
Yes, he is. He saw an improvement before we ran the soil quality test. He has seen an improvement in the trees. The trees are starting to push again, whereas before they were just kind of sitting stagnant, kind of basically just surviving. He has seen an improvement in his trees, both with, again, pushing, and then also his other issue was a crown gall issue. And even though, you know, the brassicas, the cover crop, doesn't deal with crown gall, I think it gave the trees enough of a growth or, you know, strength now, because they don't have to deal with the phytophthora. They're now fighting the crown gall, and he's seeing an improvement in that as well.
Yeah. When we were talking earlier, one of the things you mentioned was he changed his cover crops a little bit and added something, right?
Daikon radish, yeah. And the reason why he added daikon radish was to improve compaction and soil water infiltration.
And what does Daniel primarily grow?
He has 200 acres of walnut.
That is a very interesting story. You mentioned he's a very forward-thinking grower, part of a community up there, and they really focus on working with the land rather than just working on it. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes. He has been following with, he's been listening to Gabe Brown, who is a farmer rancher in, I think it's South Dakota. I'm not sure if it's in North Dakota or South Dakota. Big proponent of soil health. And has a lot of good things to say. A lot of down-to-earth things to say. And so Daniel really took that to heart. But that's not his only resource. He's extremely well-read in soil health and plant physiology. And he takes that and he views his orchard as a lab. He takes what he's, you know, what he's learned, and he's applying it to the land.
This is Farm City News Day by AgMet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agmetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgMet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. In today's Almond Update, brought to you by the Almond Board of California, you can find them online at almonds.com. India is the second largest market for almond exports, driven by cultural traditions. But the Almond Board of California says there is still a lot of room for growth. AgNet West's Brian German has the interview.
My name is Sudarshan Mazumdar. I'm Regional Director, India for Almond Board of California.
And we're here at the Almond Conference, and you were speaking on the market in India and how the consumption is driven a lot by tradition.
Yes, that's right. In India, almonds have been consumed over centuries. It's part of the Indian tradition and part of the Indian culture. And this whole tradition passes on from generation to generation to the women in the house. And with the tradition, there are lots of beliefs. And we have been reinforcing these beliefs and building up the market.
And speaking of that market, India is a huge export destination. So that consumption rate will really play a lot into production here in California.
Yes, I think India last year was the second largest export destination, 167 million pounds. But what's interesting is that the per capita consumption of addressable population of India is still very low, at 0.39 pounds a person compared to North America. It's closer to 2 pounds a person. And we know we are an economy which is rapidly growing. Incomes are rising. People are getting more sensitized about their health. In fact, lifestyle diseases are on the increase. So keeping all that in mind, I think India's got a huge potential to grow, and that'll have a lot of implications for shipments to California and how it helps in supporting the increase of production in California.
And that was kind of what you were talking about, is increasing the frequency of consumption through kind of your campaign for family consumption campaign, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Because what we find from our research is that while 40% of the consumers say they have almonds every day, but 49% of the people say they're having almonds once a week, several times a week, or several times a month. Now, these are people who are obviously convinced about the benefits of almonds, but they're simply not having it often enough. So if we can make them increase the frequency of consumption, we can get a big growth of the market. And that's exactly what a campaign is doing. What a campaign has done is positioning almonds as a small investment for a long-term success. So it's like you have your almonds every day, and long-term, you're going to really see the benefits of it. And the whole thought is that, you know, opportunities or challenges become in the future, but you're best prepared for success if you've invested in yourself by having almonds.
And it's kind of a change a little bit in direction by expanding your primary audience, kind of based on some of the cultural changes of maybe the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, traditionally almonds have always been given to children. Mothers have been giving to children because they seem to be good brain food and provide energy through the day. But what has happened is the Indian market is growing very rapidly. The Indian economy is growing very rapidly. A lot of opportunities are coming up. But because of the growing population, there's also a lot of competitiveness to make sure you achieve in that context. And therefore, the same benefits of brain of energy now, it's becoming very relevant for adults also. You have to be alert in today's world. You have to be energetic in today's world. You have to be willing to have sustained performance. And that's where almonds is fitting in more and more naturally, keeping in mind the changes happening in India.
So with these changes and your change in campaign strategy, combined with the expanding middle class consumers, it's a pretty positive outlook for growth of California almonds in India.
Yes, of course, because the middle class is growing very rapidly as the economy is growing. It was just 13.3 million households in 2005. It's already grown 4.5 times, and it's going to double to 128 million households by 2025, by which time it'll be 46% of the population. So we're going to have a huge amount of people who can afford to buy almonds, who will have the disposable income to buy almonds. And that's one of the things we have done as part of the campaign. From earlier just talking to mothers to give almonds to the children, and we have now expanded to being here. This is a family consumption product. All of you can have it. You can should have it every day and invest in yourselves and really get look for the achievements you want long-term in life.
And now for a recap of today's top stories.
There's one prime example of USDA research labs adding value to American crops. Bill Ortz is the lead for bioproducts research in his USDA facility in the Bay Area. Ortz said there is a top-notch example that reminds them of why they research different things in their lab.
So one of our entomologists, one of our scientists, discovered why apples turn brown, and in that discovery figured he could reverse the browning. And it's just adding vitamin C and calcium. So vitamin C and chalk dust combined in the right way, which he patented, prevents an apple from browning for 40 or 50 days in the fridge. And then we patented with a company, and it's been sold to McDonald's, and those are the apple slices you see at McDonald's or Subway or Nature Seal at Safeway.
Ortz said getting to market with a product is their ultimate goal, but it's a goal because it adds value or income to U.S. producers.
We went to market. It's our ultimate goal. We worked with a company. We also enabled the American farmer to sell 65 million pounds of American apples every year with that invention.
So I'm Taylor Hillman for Agnet West Radio Network.
At the recent Spring Citrus meeting in Tulare, attendees were presented with information from a UC study about the height of citrus trees and its relation to productivity. Cooperative Extension Citrus and Pistachio Farm Advisor in Kern County, Craig Carlson, noted what tree height appeared to be the most successful.
So if you've got a 20-foot distance between trees, your maximum height should probably be around 16 feet. And I think our study pretty well showed that. So there's no point in having a 20-foot tree if light doesn't reach the bottom of the canopy. You're just moving the entire crop surface or you're harvesting from up, which leaves you probably 4 or 5 feet at the bottom of the tree with no fruit. You got a tall tree, it's harder to spray to get the spray up there to control insects. You've got a poor person up on a 20-foot ladder, which a lot of them don't even have on their trucks anymore. It's a lot of time taking that sack of oranges, you know, down the tree once you've picked it. There's a lot of efficiency gain by having trees that are shorter. We don't want them so short, though, that it impacts our yield badly, so we got to find that balance.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.